It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In what appears to be an election year nod to farm state Republicans, President Trump has ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to allow the year-round sale of gasoline with higher blends of ethanol, up to 15%. That's good news for corn growers and ethanol plants. What does it mean for the rest of us? We'll talk about that with a reporter who's been following this story. Eric Wolf covers energy policy and politics for Politico. His recent piece there is titled, Trump's Ethanol Move Delivers Gift to Corn Country. Eric, welcome to the Morning Show. Good morning.
Good morning.
First off, could you explain the current restrictions on ethanol sales and then tell us what would change under this order?
Yeah, right now, most gasoline is 10% ethanol, which is biofuel mostly made out of corn in this country. That's almost what, when you go fill up at the pump, you're probably buying E10. You may not even realize it. What corn growers and ethanol producers want, you know, like any businesses, they want more market, and they want to take advantage of this government program called the Renewable Fuel Standard, which requires a certain amount of ethanol to get blended into gas. But they want permission to put more fuel in, and so go up to 15%. But the Clean Air Act makes that hard. There are restrictions. You know, during the summer it gets hot. We have a lot of ozone alert days or smog alert days, and this fuel is thought that it may contribute to that problem. So the Clean Air Act creates these restrictions. EPA, President Trump, through the EPA, is saying, let's change that rule. This is sort of outdated, and we think that, and you know, by allowing year-round sales, gasoline stations will be able to just have the necessary pumps to sell it year-round. They won't think, what's the point of having these pumps for only 8 months of the year, right? Half the year, the main driving season, they won't be able to buy it. So now the theory is, if you can get demand year-round, you would install the pumps. Corn growers are happy. Ethanol producers would be happy. Oil producers not so happy, because if there's more ethanol, there's less gasoline.
I mean, your average driver is probably not too concerned with this move, but for farmers who haven't exactly seen eye to eye with the president lately, this has got to be just a huge deal.
Yeah, I mean, it may not have an immediate impact because this infrastructure has to be installed and built, so that takes time. But yeah, I mean, some of the trade associations are saying two billion. I hope they have that number right, not 2 million, but more bushels a year. Of demand that would go into ethanol and, you know, would, you know, essentially into your car. So it's a lot more corn.
Now, the petroleum industry is not a fan of this change. What's the problem here? What's the source of this dispute?
I mean, that basic is what I was saying earlier. You know, if your gallon of gas is 5% more ethanol, it's 5% less gasoline. You know, they make a lot of arguments. Both sides have their share of arguments. It's hard for me to say which ones are correct, but you know, they'll tell you that cars aren't really designed for it. There's a risk of voiding warranty. There's a lot of concern about something called misfueling, where somebody doesn't mean to put E15 into their car. They say it's bad for consumers. And on the other side, you know, the ethanol guys say, hey, ethanol is cheaper than gasoline. You can lower prices because of this program, this, you know, sort of obscure program. It's actually slightly subsidized. So, you know, everybody claims to be pro-consumer.
Mm-hmm. What about the petroleum industry has also got some concerns about biofuel credits and the way those are swapped on the open market. People who don't even produce fuel are buying these credits and sitting on them. What's all that about?
Yeah, now we're really going to get into the weeds on this program. But the way EPA administers it is they make refiners and importers prove that they've blended the fuel through these credits, but some refiners can't actually do the blending. So they have to buy credits on the market, and there is a lot of concern that big banks like Goldman and whatnot are just seeing an investment opportunity here, that they can buy these credits, hold on to them, wait for the, you know, bet that the price will rise, and then sell them to the refiners who are absolutely required to buy them and turn them into the government annually. Now, there's some dispute about how big an effect that is. When you stay away from the details, you know, the corn farmers say, you know, sure, we love transparency, and, you know, but honestly, the sense among both sides that maybe these measures aren't going to be that helpful, and certainly the petroleum industry feels that they're not a good trade-off for this loss of market share.
And probably a lawsuit coming here somewhere. Eric Wolf covers energy policy and politics for Politico. His recent piece there is titled "Trump's Ethanol Move Delivers Gift to Corn Country." Okay, well, let's get out of the weeds and talk about the politics of this, because that's really the big deal here. In your piece, you say this is a gift from President Trump to farm state Republicans. Let's hear more about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really no coincidence that this is happening 30 days before an election, big midterms election. If Iowa is the number one, I know you grow a lot of corn in Wisconsin as well, but Iowa is the number one corn producing state. It's also the number one ethanol producing state. And there are two endangered Republican members of Congress there, as well as the governor of Iowa is trailing. All of those people have made this E15 thing a big issue, and now they can go home and say, hey, look what I got from the president. I delivered this for you. And as your listeners know better than I do, it's been tough times for farmers recently, and this is, a pretty clear-cut boost, even if it doesn't help today. A lot of folks feel that it will help as it develops.
Well, farmers weren't too happy with the president over the whole tariff thing, so this has got to maybe turn some of that anger away a little bit, at least for the corn farmers. Doesn't do much for the soybean growers, though.
It doesn't do a ton for soybean. This is another sort of complication of the program. Soybeans can be used to produce another biofuel, biodiesel, that used a lot more in trucks. And because of the complications of the program, biodiesel can be used to comply with it. So it actually could be one of those rising tide lifts all boats kind of situations. Again, I don't want to take a position on it. The oil industry would say, no, this isn't going to help anyone. But I think most of the biofuels producers would say that this will help soybean farmers as well.
So your average driver wants to know, and I guess I would be one of those average drivers here in the Midwest, is this something that's going to lower my expenses for driving my car, or is it too soon to know that?
It's a little too soon to tell, but I think probably because ethanol is a lower cost fuel. And it does come with this subsidy, so it does cost a little less. They may save a few pennies a gallon, especially once the gas stations and everything, fix up their, get their infrastructure paid off when they put their new pumps in and so on and so forth. But in Wisconsin, you probably have a lot of those pumps already installed. This fuel is much more common in the Midwest than it is here on the coast.
There's a E15 all over the place here, but it also comes with there's a sticker on those pumps telling you that your car may not be suitable for this fuel. So it kind of comes with a warning.
Yeah, and EPA has said that most of the late model cars can handle it. And again, the oil industry is always talking about that it might void your warranty. You probably should take a look at your auto manual and make sure it won't be a problem.
So what do you see as happening next year? As you mentioned, we're probably going to end up in court. But in the meantime, just before the election, looks like a pretty good gift.
Yeah, I mean, the administration has plenty of time on this. EPA has to go through a very formal process where they propose a rule, and then everybody comments on the rule, and then it's finalized and all this other stuff. It's easily going to be 6-7 months before there's something official for anyone to sue on. By that time, this election will be long over, and probably the president will be hoping to use it in his reelection campaign.
Okay. Eric Wolf, thanks. Thanks for being here this morning. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Eric Wolf covers energy policy and politics for Politico. His recent piece there is titled "Trump's Ethanol Move Delivers Gift to Corn Country." It's the morning show. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Turns out we're more likely to trust commercial airline pilots with Midwestern accents than those with Southern accents, according to a recent study. But just what is the Midwestern accent? And for that matter, what is the Wisconsin accent? Well, we have a linguistics professor who will weigh in and tell us it's more nuanced than the stereotypes. Do you have a Wisconsin accent? What do you like about it? What have you noticed other people like about it? What do people say about your accent when you're outside of the Badger State? Are you ever confused for a Minnesotan or even a Canadian? And does that bother you? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Joe Salmons is a co-director of the University of Wisconsin Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He's also a professor of language sciences. Joe, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show today.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Because we're focusing on accents today, I wanted to make sure that we got this out of the way first. What is the difference between an accent and a dialect?
That's a really good question. An accent refers basically to pronunciation, whereas dialect involves words and sentence structures and things like that. So I'm from the South, and you may hear it to some extent or other, have a Southern accent, but I also use different words. I use different pronouns. I say y'all instead of you for a plural. I have a different grammar. I can say things like you might should do that. Accent is a much more focused term.
Well, I have to say that your accent doesn't sound very Southern to me, but maybe after we talk for a while, I'll pick that up. So what are the characteristics of the Wisconsin accent as we know it today?
Well, it's changing very rapidly, and they're very new, first of all. So things are just, in some ways, starting to emerge. A couple of things that you hear a lot in Wisconsin include people having a distinctive pronunciation of the A vowel, of the vowel in bad and bat and so forth, specifically when it comes before a G. So people will talk about the stereotype of Wisconsinites, how Wisconsinites say bag. That's one thing that is pretty distinctive. You hear it some in Minnesota and through the Dakotas and in some parts of Canada, but that's pretty well associated with Wisconsin for a lot of people. Other things are coming through right now. So most Americans still have a distinction between the man's name Don and the woman's name Dawn, or words like caught, C-O-T, and caught, the past tense of to catch. But that's going away, and it's going away pretty fast, and that's something that's happening right now in the state.
Well, these things evolve all the time, don't they? I mean, our language is constantly changing. The words we use are constantly evolving. It would make sense that the way we say things does, too. Do these happen? What causes this evolution?
Well, there is has always been, as far as we can tell, a huge amount of variability in language. Like you say, things are always changing, but there's also a big pool of variables in speech. Not everybody here speaks the same way, so we've got these opportunities to pick up on things and to change in one direction or another. And a lot of these changes that are happening are things that have been going on for a very, very long time. So the change with the A vowel, that's a characteristic that English has had since before it was really English. It goes back to the family. It's been happening for 2,000 years in some sense. And it's not exactly the same change because we're starting from different points, but it's going. So it really is it's very constant. What direction we go in is determined a lot by adjusting to our peer groups. So it's not necessarily that we try to sound like, we don't try to sound like people on the radio or the television necessarily. We tend to adjust ourselves to the people we're close to peer groups, to people we identify with. And as you change who you interact with, that gives you new targets to aim for.
We asked people to leave us a voicemail saying a particular sentence so that you could assess just how many Wisconsin characteristics they exhibit. We've got an example from Pam, who's from Whitewater. Let's hear that.
The latest ag report shows strong production, but with the hot weather now, Don knows there's bad news coming today.
So, Joe, what are you hearing here?
So she doesn't have that much of the – so an ag report, it sounds to me like ag, and I looked at it phonetically. It looks like ag. So she doesn't have that much of that particular characteristic. She has another characteristic that we find a whole lot now in people from eastern Wisconsin, basically east of Madison and up along Lake Michigan. Pretty far north, and that is in words like news. She says the Z at the end, more or less like an S, so it sounds like noose. A lot of Americans do that variably, occasionally, but a lot of Wisconsinites in that part of the state are now doing that pretty regularly. It's a pretty common feature of her speech, and she does that. She does it pretty often.
I've always been told that replacing the Z with the Z sound with an S is kind of a product of the Scandinavian heritage of a lot of the people who settled in Wisconsin in the 19th century.
That's what you hear in Scandinavian communities, and if you go to German communities, they'll say, "Oh, that's because we're German." Or if you go to Polish communities, they'll say, "Oh, that's because we sound Polish." A whole lot of languages that were brought by immigrants to the state in the 19th century and into the 20th century don't have a Z sound, especially at the ends of words. And so it was not one group necessarily. It does show up in those particular areas, but it's sort of solidified from those areas and has now become a broad regional pattern. It's found, by the way, outside of the east, but I mentioned the eastern part of the state because it's particularly strong there.
Okay. Let's take a phone call. John is joining us from Richland Center. John, good morning.
Good morning. I lived in Wisconsin all my life. I survived 60 winters here, and I would like to say I am a Midwestern. Two words. I am from Milwaukee, and the old-timers used to say I am from Milwaukee, and we have the D's, days, and don'ts. D's is these. Days is they, and don'ts is do not.
And John, thanks for that. Also, I've heard people drop the L from Milwaukee so that it comes out like Milwaukee. It's like people who, instead of saying Baltimore, they say Baltimore.
Yeah, so there's a whole lot going on there. The replacement of W sounds by V sounds is something that you have a lot with bilinguals. I'm working now with a lot of recordings of Norwegian Americans from Wisconsin who are bilinguals, and you get that in their speech. It doesn't survive that much in monolingual speech once people become only English speaking. They don't tend to have that usually. With the what we often call dim, dare, and does, so them, there, and those, that's a very strong feature, much like the S pronunciation. That's one that has immigrant roots. A lot of these languages that were brought to Wisconsin early on don't have the TH sounds, th and the, like we do, and they're very hard for adults to learn, and so people made that replacement. And again, it's a case where a feature was not limited to one group. It was found across a lot of groups, and that makes it easier to get into ordinary speech. But what's happened in that case is it's now, John rightly points out that it's an old Milwaukee feature. Today, it's become, for a lot of people, more identified with rural parts of the state. When I give talks around the state and ask people who says dim, dare, and does, people, whether it's a rural area or an urban area, a lot of people will say, oh, that's something that is more rural today. And with Milwaukee pronounced very briefly, that's a wonderful example. Words that we use a whole lot, we tend to say faster. We shorten them. If you're from a place and the place has a long name, then you've got a really good opportunity to shorten it. So Milwaukee is a perfect example. Louisville in Kentucky, Baltimore, the example you gave, those are really good ones. I think there's a beautiful study to be done taking people from Wisconsin places like Manitowoc and Oconomowoc and see if they pronounce their own city shorter than people from other parts of the state do.
Well, one of the things I miss about the Milwaukee Brewers being in the American League is getting a chance to hear Bob Uecker say the Baltimoreals. We're talking about that Wisconsin accent that we have, whether we know it or not, and we are going to continue that discussion. Joe Salmon stays with us as we talk about what makes someone from Wisconsin sound, well, like someone from Wisconsin. That conversation will continue after the news. Also, Wisconsin Attorney General candidates Brad Schimmel and Josh Call will debate for the first time this Friday night at 7:30. WPR brings you the debate live, moderated by Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg and WPR's Sean Johnson. Ahead of that debate, join us for a special that looks at the Wisconsin candidates for U.S. Senate. That's Friday night at 7, followed by the debate at 7:30. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, you know, when you hear it, it's the Wisconsin accent.
The latest ag report shows strong production,
but with the hot weather now.
Don knows there's bad news coming today.
Don knows there's bad news coming today.
Don knows there's bad news coming today.
Some words just bring out the Scotty in us. Do you and your friends from other places argue over the correct way to say certain words? And what do you think makes the Wisconsin accent different from the way Minnesotans sound or the way Canadians talk, eh? Did you grow up speaking like a Scotty, or did you pick it up later after you moved here? Give us a call and let us know. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email. All that will be less fun. ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. But if you tweet us, be sure to do it in a Wisconsin accent. Joe Selmans is a co-director of the University of Wisconsin Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He's with us today to help us sort out this whole Wisconsin accent thing. So, Joe, what did you hear in that little montage there?
Well, I heard some pretty classic features. The ag report, you have the egg sound, where if you take that word out, the short form of agriculture, and you just play that for people, a couple of the speakers will be interpreted by especially non-Wisconsinites, but to a certain extent Wisconsinites, as having said egg, the thing that a hen lays. And the thing that a lot of people are making for breakfast right now, probably. Another thing that's clear in all three speakers is that in that sentence, the name was the woman's name, Dawn. But all three of those speakers sound to me like they're saying Don. And I played the clips for a couple of Wisconsinites and non-Wisconsinites yesterday, and they all heard in almost every case the man's name Don. So that shows that recent change is coming through pretty clearly in those three speakers.
Is this something that's pretty common across the state? I know that from talking with other linguists over the years on other programs, there is a lot of regional variation based on what the ethnic heritage is of a particular part of the state. But are there certain characteristics that are just true no matter where you are in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and this is one, the Don thing is something that we used to think of as coming in from the west and sort of sweeping eastward, but it looks like it's popping up all over the place now. There are definitely regional differences within the state in accent and otherwise. In the southeast corner of the state, you get people pronouncing the avowel in words like bad and mad and so forth. More like what you would hear in Chicago or Cleveland or places like that. So you get kind of a bad sound. And in that same southeastern corner for hockey, people will say something a little bit more like hacky, so a little closer to hacky. Not as extreme as it would be in Detroit or Chicago, but tending that way, and enough so that it will sound different than a lot of the state.
Let's go to the phones. Liz is ready to join us in Viroqua. Liz, let's hear from you this morning.
Yes, I have a question for your guest. I have the first two volumes of the Dictionary of American Regional English, and I think it takes me through the letter H. You obviously know about this work. Is the whole thing done yet?
The whole thing is done, yes. And thank you for raising that, talking about the Dictionary of American Regional English. Today is Frederick Cassidy Day. Frederick Cassidy was a professor in English here. He started the project. He did sound recordings in the 1950s that led up to the recordings for the dictionary in the 1960s. It's all done. We have recordings from every part of the United States made basically from 1968 to 1971. It's a huge resource for all of us. If you have access to most libraries, you can get DARE, as we call the Dictionary of American Regional English, online. So you can search online for particular words, and a lot about pronunciation, a lot about grammar and so forth, too. It's a huge resource, and it's a wonderful thing that comes from Wisconsin.
Liz, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Lisa in Delavan. Lisa, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Well, good morning. Is it Frederick Cassidy Day?
Yes.
Happy Frederick Cassidy Day. I didn't know. I'll let my students know.
Is there a greeting card for this day, too?
I don't think there is, but we have one, don't you think?
Really?
We moved here in 2002 from California. I grew up as a military dependent. My dad was in the Air Force for 20 years. Grew up everywhere. I kind of think I don't have an accent. My students think I have a southern accent. I don't personally hear that very often. But we have three children. They're all grown now, our oldest and our youngest. Their dialect really didn't shift at all, but our middle child, who is a CPA in Madison, and Ellen, if you're listening, this is Mom, she absolutely sounds like she was born and raised here all of her life. And she was probably, I think, sixth grade when we got here. And it's just really shifted. And it's interesting to see within our family, within our household, you know, one child adopting that dialect and the others. Is there a reason for that? I mean, what is it about us that makes us more prone or susceptible to adapting our dialect when we move as children?
Really good question. That's an area where there's a huge amount of research happening right now. Kids can adjust, and a lot of kids do adjust. And sixth grade is pretty much a perfect time for somebody to realign themselves. Some of it has to do with the peer group associations. In that pre-adolescent, adolescent time, you really have very strong peer groups, and you really want to sound like and be like your friends. So it probably goes back to who they were hanging out with and what kind of accents those people had. But that's a very common thing within families, to get differences within a set of siblings.
Lisa, thanks. Thanks for that call. Is it true some people are just sort of natural mimics and they tend to just blend in? I find myself doing this. Whatever group I'm with, after an hour, I find myself talking the way they do, and I just pretty much can't even help myself, which makes a lot of my Canadian friends really laugh when they hear me say a boot or something like that. But are some of us more prone to just kind of blend in that way?
It's the easiest question of the morning, for sure. Yes. Some people are really good at it, but there, as we get older, once we're past our early 20s, it's harder to pick up certain things. So you can get the basic patterns, but if you study somebody's speech, you can tell. Even somebody who moves to a new place, say in their teens, in a lot of places they will basically sound like they're from there, but if you really investigate all of the details of their speech, you'll see that there's some things they haven't adjusted to, they haven't picked up on. So some people are clearly much better at it, and I envy those people, I have to confess. There are limits to how good we are at that.
And I also noticed that Lisa pronounced the T in often. Is that a regional thing, and where is it from?
Oh, that is not a regional thing.
Okay.
The word historically never had a T in it, but when English spelling got set, they put a T in it, and it's what we call a spelling pronunciation. And I normally don't have many spelling pronunciations. I was giving a public talk a couple of years ago, and somebody asked exactly that question, and I said, oh, that shouldn't be there. That's only people who pay too much attention to spelling. And 10 minutes later in the Q&A, the whole audience just went crazy laughing. And I said, what? And they said, oh, you just said often.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, I'm glad to get that question answered. Let's hear from Mark in Oconomowoc next. Mark, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Hi. Greetings. There is no I wanted to make a couple comments. One was about Manitowoc and Oconomowoc, whether we're tempted to shorten it up by dropping a consonant or vowel. Not yet out here. After 25 years, they do refer to the town as Cooney, but that's their sports name, but based on Oconomowoc. But next to Manitowoc, they definitely, where I used to live, have shortened that up from Two Rivers to Trivers, so they kind of contract that. But the comment that I, or question I have is, having studied German and Norwegian, ST and SP are often pronounced in those countries with a SH sound, like Spiel or Stick. But my daughter is now, in the last couple of years, talking about going to strength training, and I'm wondering where this SH creep has come from, if it's a local thing or a national thing or just a sloppy thing. But I hear it even on news programs from national TV, so I'm wondering if it's what your opinion is on that.
It's something that's happening all over the country, and it's a really interesting change for a whole set of reasons. The example you gave is perfect strength. The sentence that the people read had the word strong in it. And if you go back and listen to the three of them, one of them had pretty much a sh, one was sort of in between, and one had a s.
Yeah, that drives me crazy when I hear that.
It's spreading, and I'm sorry, but you're not going to stop it. It's just in two generations, it's gonna be the norm. But it's very specifically for most people, like in strength and strong, it's in the cases with S, T, and R. Some people have generalized it to just S, T, or S, P type things, but it's mostly in when there's an R following.
I guess I had either the fortune or misfortune of being raised by a radio announcer to have good diction, and so it bothers me when I don't hear it. We are going to continue our conversation with Joe Salmons about this Wisconsin accent thing. Do you think you have a Wisconsin accent? And if so, how does it manifest itself? Are you maybe a recent transplant? What do you think about how we talk up here in the North, eh? When we come back, I want to talk about the difference between the actual accent and the stereotype, which I just illustrated. And we've got some other stuff to do, too. So lots to come here on The Morning Show. So stick around with us. Joe Salmons is co-director of the University of Wisconsin Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. 800-642-1234. Tell us about your Wisconsin accent. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, you know it when you hear it. It's the Wisconsin accent.
The latest ag report shows strong production, but with the hot weather now, Don knows there's bad news coming today.
Some words just bring out the Scotty. Do you and your friends from other places argue over the correct way to say certain words? And what do you think makes the Wisconsin accent different from the way Minnesotans sound or the way the Canadians talk? Did you grow up speaking like a Wisconsinite? Or did you pick it up later after you moved here? Call us at 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. That was WPR's own Rich Kramer, our reporter from Eau Claire, who grew up in Superior. And I happen to know this because my wife was his elementary school teacher. Joe Salmon, what did you think of Rich's accent?
You've got some classic features there. One thing that we haven't talked about this morning is the A and O pronunciations that we get a lot. And you can hear it, I think, in all three of those. where in the speech of most Americans, you get something that's fairly diphthongal. You have sort of two vowel qualities. So I say words like say and know, where the vowel quality changes a bunch. But Wisconsinites and Minnesotans will tend to say say and know. They're much more stable. They're much more monophthongal. And those can be taken. So people will talk about the Minnesota O in Wisconsin. And when I first moved here, I thought it was hilarious because I would ask Wisconsinites, well, how do you recognize a Minnesota accent? And they say, oh, they say, oh, funny. And I went to Minnesota and said, how do you recognize a Wisconsin accent? And they said, oh, they say their O is funny. And I couldn't figure out. It sounded like they were both saying the same thing. It turns out that phonetically, there's a little bit of a difference that I'm completely deaf to as an outsider, but that people in this region can hear from each other. They're both very monophthongal to my ear, but if you look at it, if you do a computer analysis of the sound waves, you'll see that they're moving slightly, but they're moving in opposite directions. So that's something that's pretty pervasive, and that's we hear a little bit of that in there.
Let's go next to Lisa, who is calling us from Pittsville. Lisa, hello.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Well, I'm from the Midwest, and I've lived in central Wisconsin all my life. And several years ago, I attended a professional conference, and I was the only one from the Midwest. Everybody else was from the South, and they all complimented me on my accent when I thought they were the ones with the accent, and I was the one without one. And also noteworthy was it was in May, and they were all freezing, and I had my jacket off.
Yeah. You can always tell who the snowbirds are in Arizona in January because they're wearing shorts and everybody else is in a survival parka. What about Lisa's story here, Joe?
I can assure you, everybody has an accent if you go somewhere else. And a lot of times we're not aware of it until we move outside of the area where we grew up. The perception of different accents is really pretty dramatic across the country, not just in terms of who has one and what we can identify, but also what we think sounds pleasant, what we think sounds correct, and so forth. In Wisconsin, we're really in sort of a sweet spot. There's a really famous set of studies, part of them by Nancy Najelski, part of them by Dennis Preston and other people, where they gave people maps of the United States and said, okay, just draw the places where you think people speak the most pleasant English and the most correct English. And they did it with a bunch of Michiganders and a bunch of Alabamians. And the Michiganders thought that Michigan was the most correct, the South was the least correct. And the Alabamians were not too, they pretty much agreed on that. They thought that Northerners sounded much more correct, especially the Midwest. But when it came to pleasantness, everybody agreed that the Southerners sounded pleasant. In Wisconsin, we just recently did a survey. Miranda Wilkerson, a colleague, and I did a survey of almost 2,000 Wisconsinites, and we asked, do you think Wisconsin English sounds friendly? And overwhelmingly, people said yes. We asked, can you hear a Wisconsin accent? Can you identify somebody who's from Wisconsin? And people said yes, but not quite so powerfully. We also asked, by the way, if people thought that Wisconsin English was correct English, and it dropped down a little bit, not like Alabamians or Michiganders think about Alabama speech, but it was not, people didn't think of Wisconsin English as particularly the most correct English.
A recent survey found that Americans were more likely to trust commercial pilots with Midwestern accents than they were commercial pilots with Southern accents, especially from Texas. Joe, we had a caller earlier who couldn't stay on the line who said he went to China and taught. He's from Wisconsin, and the Chinese loved his accent, and that was the kind of English they wanted to learn how to speak. So what's up with people finding Midwestern-sounding accents more trustworthy?
Well, this is not something about language in and of itself. It's something about attitudes toward the region that get reflected in language. We can have completely different reactions to exactly the same linguistic feature. depending on how we think about the particular group. So if we listen to somebody with a British accent and they don't pronounce their R's at the ends of words, that will sound fancy, sophisticated to a lot of Americans. But if we have a Southern stereotypical redneck sheriff doing exactly that same feature, that will signal something very, very different. So it's about the cultural image and attitudes toward an area, toward a set of people and so forth, and language is just sort of implicated in that. It's not about the language per se.
Let's take a quick call from Dan in Maribel. Dan, go ahead.
Hey, I live in a little village called Maribel, which is really Maribel, but the question I had is there's a town nearby called Wrightstown, and instead of saying you guys, they say you guys, and so it's you guys instead of you guys. I had a friend who worked there and coached basketball, and he kept telling the, you know, the players, it's you guys, and then he got to a game, and all the parents in the crowd were yelling, go get them, you guys! Go get them, you guys! So I'm wondering where that came from.
Dan, thanks for the call. So, you guys, where's that one come from?
So, there's a weird thing about English. We have singular versus plural pronouns. So we say I and we and he or she and they and so forth. We don't have that for the second person. So we have you and you in the standard language. It hasn't always been that way, but it's that way now. And different dialects of English have come up with lots of different solutions to that problem by inventing new plural pronouns. In the South, you get y'all, and in the Highland South in Appalachia, you get yuns. Pittsburgh has yens. In parts of the upper Midwest, you get you guys, and for a lot of people, that's not gendered. That refers equally easily to males or females. You get you guys. You also, in certain parts of the state, in northern Wisconsin, for example, I've heard it a lot, you get people just saying use as a use should do this or that.
Mm-hmm. Knowing what we know about how language and accents move and evolve, what changes could we expect to see in the Wisconsin accent in the coming years, do you think?
I predict that it's going to get more distinctive, but it's going to get more distinctive exactly in the ways that your three recordings are. That is, it's not going to be the stereotype Northwoods stuff. It's going to be these subtle changes that we're hearing, the kind of stuff we've been talking about this morning, that are going to get stronger and stronger over time.
Well, we'll have to keep an ear out for that. We left a lot on the table here. We could probably have done several hours on this, and I know our callers enjoyed it, and I sure enjoyed listening to the way we talk, and it's not funny. We don't talk funny, I insist. Joe Selmans is co-director of the University of Wisconsin Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He's also professor of language sciences. Thank you so much, Joe, for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.